I have a quick question.
Yeah.
Have you, does this data have things on race and ethnicity?
We do have an indicator for First Nations, whether or not you're First Nations. Native American. That indicator requires you to have collaboration with the Assembly of Manitoba Chiefs, as well as with the federal FINIV, First Nations branch. We don't have other race ethnicity data as administrative data.
Mm-hmm.
What I didn't mention here is we also have non-administrative data, such as somewhat similar to what was mentioned earlier. It's called the Canadian Community Health Survey, and there we have some other social indicators like that. But as administrative data, we don't have an administrative indicator other than First Nations status.
Okay, because that could be an interesting observation, especially when you're looking into the social determinants.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
Disparities.
Yeah, absolutely. Yep.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you so much.
I'll just pass the title slide. Go ahead.
No problem. Our next speaker is Dr. Dan Chidjo. He's a research scientist at the Manitoba Center of Health Policy and an assistant professor in the Department of Community Health Sciences at the University of Manitoba. He completed his PhD in cognitive psychology at the University of Western Ontario and has conducted research at the center and also served as a consultant in the Biostatistics Consulting Unit in the College of Medicine, Faculty of Health Sciences. These positions have provided him a strong base in health service research and quantitative service research methods. Recently, he is a member of the Quantitative Methods Team for the Canadian Network of Observational Drug Effect Studies, CNOS, and as a co-PI on the large multi-year grant investigating the effects of policies and interventions on health equity in Manitoba's children. Welcome.
Thank you. I'd like to thank everybody for coming and see we're all still safe, so that's good. We've got a clear aisle. When we submitted these abstracts so many months ago, we weren't quite sure that we'd be put in the same session, so now that I'm following Nathan, it's going to be a little bit different than the abstract. I'm going to be able to skip some of the description of the past cohort and the data and get to a few examples of this data in action. The first one is about social housing. And so I'm sure that there's social housing all over the United States, just like there is in Manitoba. One of the data partners that Nathan mentioned was the Ministry of Housing.
Can you speak to the microphone?
I'm not very close.
Yeah.
Sorry? Okay. Let me get closer. The Ministry of Housing. And so we wanted to engage in a project that would evaluate their intervention or policy, which is essentially giving people housing or providing people with housing. So what impact would that have on children who are living in housing? Would it make a difference? And in particular, for this particular project, would it make a difference where the house's social housing was located? So there are about 30,000 people living in social housing, about 50% are under the age of 20. So it's a young crowd. It tends to be bimodal. There's a lot of young people in social housing and then some elderly. We're able to locate exactly where the social housing units are, all of them in the province, and we concentrated on the major city of Winnipeg, which is about 850,000 in the greater area, and located all the housing in what kind of neighborhood it was located in. Was it a particularly wealthy neighborhood, poor neighborhood, etc.? We divide the city into 72 pieces, and what we saw first is that there is some concentration of housing in poorer areas, but there is housing located in all areas. There's social housing units in very wealthy areas, social housing units in very poor areas, and all areas in between. So that gives us the opportunity to evaluate the impact of the neighborhood on the students who, the children who are living in the housing units. So are there differences in health and education outcomes between children living in social housing or not? And I think for the most part, we're expecting to see that. It's this extra piece. Does it matter where the social housing unit is located, and is that going to add to the outcomes? What we do see, and so I'm skipping some of the methods because I'm going to get to three examples. Here's what something that we did see here. For children not in housing, you tend to see the socioeconomic gradient you'd expect for a very early outcome, right? 2-year immunization, complete immunization. So we have all of the immunization records. our vaccination records for the province, and we can see did they complete the whole schedule of all the vaccinations that you're supposed to get. Now, they are provided free of charge, so everybody can partake in them. You tend to see a gradient amongst the not in housing, the children in social housing. It's lower across the board, but it's the same across all neighborhoods. So where the social housing was located didn't seem to have any impact on this particular indicator. We tended to see something about the same on something known as the Early Development Instrument. I'm not sure whether it's used in the United States. It is used throughout the world. It's an instrument that is given to children in either pre-kindergarten or kindergarten to evaluate their readiness for school. And it evaluates children on five domains. And what we were looking at is children who were not ready in at least one domain. What we tended to see is that, again, if you were in housing, you were not ready in at least one domain, and it was a much higher rate, and it was consistent across all neighborhoods. So there's really no impact here. So at two, there's no impact. Now children are about five, there's still no impact of housing. You tend to see the gradient if you're not in housing, right? So these are poorer children, and they're about the same whether you're in housing or not. As you get into richer and richer neighborhoods, there's fewer and fewer children who are not ready for school. When we got to some of the older outcomes, so here it's grade 9 credits in passing. So you get to grade 9, now are you passing all your credits? Again, we see that the children in housing are doing worse, but now we begin to see an impact of where the housing is located. So they're always doing worse. You see the gradient in the not in housing. Now we're starting to see a gradient for children in housing. So in high school, if you're located in this housing unit that's in a more affluent neighborhood, your performance tends to be better than if you were in housing in a less affluent neighborhood. We saw the same thing for high school completion, a little bit more dramatic, almost somewhat bimodal. If you're in the poor neighborhoods, it's quite poor. If you get into one of the more affluent neighborhoods, it increases quite a bit. And in fact, these children here in housing are performing about the same as the children not in housing in the lower income neighborhoods. We also saw the same thing for teen pregnancy. So this one was quite encouraging as well to see that the teen pregnancy rates drop quite a bit if the social housing unit the children are living in is located in a more affluent neighborhood. Now this had a policy implication because new social housing units are being constructed and are needed. And so the question is, where are we going to put those units? And you've got a little bit of NIMBY going on. Can't have that housing unit here. We do have housing units throughout the city, though, and what we're seeing is that if you locate them in a little bit better neighborhoods, you can really improve outcomes for those children, and certainly better for everyone. So that was something that we did to try to combine our social housing data, which we're very fortunate to have, with our health data, and also our education data. And the EDI, which is the Early Development Institute, actually comes from a different department. It's not from education, it comes from the Healthy Child Manitoba office. It's a unique intergovernmental unit that takes the deputy ministers from across a whole bunch of the different ministries, and their target is just to increase health for children in Manitoba. So there's one example of being able to use this PATHS resource, use all the different types of data, and get a better picture across the spectrum of how children are doing. The higher rates of passing, the higher rates of school completion, these are major implications for the future for these children, right? If you can get through high school, it's going to have a lifelong impact, and the same goes for teen pregnancy or births. So another intervention that we examined was one known as the Early Psychosis Prevention and Intervention Service. So this is an early intervention for people with a first episode of psychosis. You get assertive community treatment, case management. You see a psychiatrist and other professionals to try to help managing psychosis, and that's a really debilitating condition to have to go through. One of the things it emphasized was adherence to medication. You do get psychotherapy. They do involve the family in the treatment, and we're hoping for some positive outcomes from the program. So we were able to link actually now a new data set that was brought in specifically for this. It's from the Manitoba Adolescent Treatment Center. Typically, our health records only include records from health professionals that can bill the province, and this does not necessarily include then social workers, who, although they get paid by the province, you don't indicate what you're doing with every patient. Psychologists don't submit to Manitoba Health, but by linking in the Manitoba Adolescent Treatment Center, we were able to put that together. So about the methods, of course, we were trying to get a little bit fancy here. We used a SAS macro to identify potential confounders, because in this particular project, that EPIS program was so good that when we were trying to find controls, we couldn't use concurrent controls. Every person who looked like somebody who should be in the EPIS program got into the EPIS program. So we had no concurrent controls that we could look at, so we actually looked for historical controls. We were wanting to make sure that if we identified somebody who had a diagnosis of psychosis, that they were somewhat like the individuals who were part of the program later. So we used a SAS macro actually developed at Harvard University, I believe. It's a high dimensional propensity score, so if anybody wants to get involved and work with administrative data, you can always look up that macro. And it looks through all of your administrative data and looks for diagnoses that could be related to both your outcome and your exposure to identify true confounders. And it's going to rank them based on the contribution or possible influence and bias. So it looks at both the prevalence and its relationship to the outcome. And we looked at a bunch of outcomes, or odds ratios for some outcomes, hazard ratios for others, rate ratios for others. We're looking at the average treatment effect, and we did use inverse probability of treatment weights, which was brought up earlier, to be able to adjust for the confounders. So one of the things that was really interesting at the outset is, first of all, when you're working with administrative data and data sets this large, we tend to look at standardized differences rather than your typical table one where you compare two groups and you get your t-test maybe if it's continuous or a chi-square test of association. And when you have these really large sample sizes, they'll all be significant no matter how big the difference is or how small the difference is. So we look at standardized differences, and there's a literature that looks at this. And so we were able to identify a series of, this is just some of them, the diagnoses associated with the groups and what might be different between our treated group and our historical control group. Most of the differences were actually quite small, even at the outset. They're all less than 0.1, and less than 0.1 is considered really not different. Some of them were a little bit larger. Age was one that was a little bit larger, and that had something to do with the way we were getting at the historical controls. The standardized difference appears big, but the actual age difference between the two groups is less than a year. So it clinically, it might not be that meaningful. There's a couple of interesting things here when you do this. You use these automated procedures, and you've got all this data available to you that we were able to find. So these are all diagnoses before entering a program or before being diagnosed with psychosis. And a couple of the ones that we actually saw come up, at first we were like, well, what's that and why is it associated? This one here, unspecified disorder of refraction or accommodation. If any of you are medical experts, you'd know that that's vision problems. And then we've also got unspecified disorder of skin subcutaneous. So there's something to do with something wrong with you've got a rash or there's something wrong. In talking to the experts, they said, well, those are likely hallucinations related to the psychosis that have been improperly diagnosed at the time. The physician isn't aware that this person is experiencing psychosis. So we're actually able to look at precursors. Not the intent of this project at all, but it does give you some idea of the power of the data. The results were actually really encouraging. We were able to look at things way beyond health. So one thing we did find is that for income assistance, for instance. So we were able to link this with with whether or not you're receiving income assistance or welfare. It's actually much higher if you were in the program, and it continued on after you left the program. So this is a sign that being part of this EPIS program has connected you to services. They're far less likely than to end up homeless, which can be an issue for people experiencing psychosis, or to maintain housing. They're also far more likely to get a prescription for an antipsychotic and actually maintain adherence for that treatment. So by being able to follow up people and link in the prescription drug, we were able to take a look at some things that you wouldn't be able to do necessarily in the short time period that the program is initiated. We can follow them for years after the program has ended and they're outside the system that would typically track them. We also found that they were more likely to end up in the emergency department, more likely to be hospitalized than be inpatients. And although this seemed a little bit counterintuitive at first, it was pointed out to us that particularly the emergency department, they train the family. Part of it was to bring the family in to recognize the symptoms of psychosis and to get them care, to get them treatment. So it may be related to that. Two positive things we did find was it reduced suicidal behavior and it also reduced criminal accusations. So this is where the justice system data is one of the first projects to actually use it, because it's a very new data set. It's really fascinating to see it used and to see an actual positive impact. Finally, very quickly, I think I've got a few more minutes, do I?
Yes.
All right. I'm going to get through one more intervention that we looked at, which is about teen birth and school enrollment. Really, the project was taking a look at in-school clinics. So the education system and the health system had started to put clinics inside schools. They wanted to take a look at how it was affecting testing for STIs and contraception. Pregnancy in particular was really their important outcome. Teen births may be more important than pregnancy, although both are there. So the in-school clinics were there, and one of the issues that came up at first is, so here's our question, how do they reduce or exacerbate inequity in pregnancy and STI rates? Is the intervention actually targeting the right people, and who is getting it? So we actually identified three groups. There's two obvious groups, adolescents attending schools without clinics, and adolescents attending schools with clinics. But there was a third group, and that's adolescents who are not enrolled in school. And the in-school clinics obviously can't really get to this group. And so as part of the policy directive, what's the size of that group? And when are people dropping out? And what's happening with people who drop out of school? So we want to examine the relationship between teen births and school enrollment, and how it might be related to socioeconomic status. So we actually stratified the analysis between kids who would be going on in school and kids who would be finishing school, just because of the dynamics of finishing off and getting your high school diploma might be different than looking forward to another full year of school. One thing we did see is that if you were in school, over half of the women re-enrolled the following year. So they continued on in school regardless of having a child. It didn't affect their school enrollment. So that was a really positive outcome, and I'm not sure that it was one that everybody was expecting to see. Maybe they're a little bit old-fashioned in their view of young pregnant women or young women who have given birth. What we did see, though, is that if you dropped out, we were actually able to take a look at whether or not you re-enrolled. So we were able to look at, did you drop out first and then get pregnant? Did you get pregnant first and then drop out? And then did you ever re-enroll after that? And one fascinating thing here is that there is very different depending on whether or not you dropped out first and got pregnant, or got pregnant and then dropped out. So it's positive to see at least that the rates weren't zero. 20% is not very high, though, and even 30% for women who had become pregnant first and then dropped out, about 30% came back to the regular school system. We don't know if they came back to get GEDs or something of that sort. And for those who are in grade 12, over half graduated the same year, and around 70% graduated within another 2 years. So the graduation rates were quite high if your teen birth was quite late. One thing that we did see in all of these is that there was really no difference by your income or income quintile. So the dynamics of teen birth don't seem to be impacted by whether or not you have a lot of money or very little money. What does seem to be so really had no effect. So there is the high likelihood of continuous enrollment, and re-enrollment after a break in school is a little bit different. Likelihood of graduating high school is quite high. Where you do see the socioeconomic difference is whether or not you get pregnant at all. And that's quite a bit higher in the lower areas than it is in the more affluent areas. It's the only income quintile in which withdrawing first before becoming pregnant is a significantly higher proportion of young women who give birth. So those are three examples of mixing together the different data systems that we're able to enjoy being able to work with in Manitoba. And I know that it's coming to to the U.S. eventually, and in places it already has. So you can look forward to working with it. In the meantime, if you want to be able to work with this type of data, as Nathan pointed out, we do have that PATH resource, which any researcher is welcome to use. You just have to go through the same approval process as actually that Nathan and I have to go through to be able to use the data. So the PATH cohort in action, well, health, education, and social services all work together for the benefit of Manitobans, and that's what's happening in Manitoba. They work together for the benefit of anybody, anywhere, including all over the United States and the world. It's great, though, to be able to get the data to work together to enhance our ability to evaluate these health and social policies and outcomes and actually use that information to guide policy and interventions. So that integrated knowledge translation system that Nathan spoke about, you know, we were actually able to take this research and meet with the deputy ministers, even the ministers I've met with, to talk about the results of the studies and what it might mean for decisions that they need to make going forward. I believe that that is everything.
Any questions for Dr. Shoju or for any of the other speakers? So all these examples and the results that you have shown are like, did you try out any multivariate risk adjustment models? Like,
so some of them include both the inverse probability treatment weights.
Okay.
Some of them also include multivariate models,
okay,
or both.
Okay.
We
so
might have an IPTW, and so they'd be doubly robust. We'd actually include covariance addition.
So what kind of other predictors that you had in the model when you did a multivariate?
Oh, geez. A lot, yeah. A big long list.
It varies based on the study, right?
Uh-huh.
So, for example, the Families First, or no, let's talk about the Healthy Baby, sorry, I should probably stand it.
Yeah.
The Healthy Baby, so one of the programs we evaluated and just got accepted someplace is we looked at the impact of sending out an $81 a month check to mothers and whether that's having any impact on child health outcomes. So the $81 a month, there's no stipulations attached to it. It's just a check, and the mother can use it in any way that she wants. And so we were concerned about confounding. So we were able to adjust for the prenatal care. We're able to adjust for a variety of birth measures. We have another program called the Families First program, which is a program where you send where home visitors go into families' homes. And it has a lot of different goals. One of them, though, is to reduce rates of child apprehension. And so every single birth has a what's called a Families First screen. So in the hospital, the nurse does the screening tool to find out whether or not the family is at risk for subsequent apprehension. And that screening tool has things like, did the mother smoke during pregnancy?
Okay.
Is the mother socially isolated? Is the father socially isolated? So a whole variety of psychosocial metrics as well as some health behavior metrics. That's given to all births. And so then we use variables from that screen as well to adjust for some confounders. The home visiting program, not home visiting, the housing program, which Dan mentioned, because we were dealing with differing levels of like neighborhood and the social housing unit, et cetera. So there we did a multiple variable, multi-level model to adjust that.
Yeah, I was just wondering like if these results were univariate or whether they were
adjusted.
Well, as Dan said,
there's a lot of voodoo. But,
yeah,
but it's not really voodoo, you know.
This is great. Okay,
yeah.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Any other questions, anybody?
Yeah. So I work for the Wyoming Department of Health, and even getting data systems within our department, we have struggles with talking to each other, and then there's governance and funding issues when we try to reach outside of the agency. Could you speak a little bit to the governance and funding of your office?
Oh, okay. Well, there's two pieces to that question. So the Manitoba Center for Health Policy started about 25 years, maybe even closer to 30 years ago now. when the Ministry of Health was looking for information about what was going on in the province, and they created the Manitoba Center for Health Policy and funded annually to do a series of projects for them. About half of our funding comes from that grant, the other half comes from competitive academic grants. So it is a pretty big chunk of money, and a good portion of it is used to maintain the database. So about 20% is there just to keep the database available and up to date. One of the things about having a single payer system in the ministries, and you know, it might have a little bit to do with the geography, which may also be true of Wyoming, is that there's not a lot of people and a lot of different cities and schools competing with each other for this type of database. Right? So in Manitoba, there's really only one place you put it. There are a number of universities, but it's going to be where the Faculty of Medicine is. So it's going to end up at the University of Manitoba. So there is a lot of cooperation between the agencies to get the data. It's unfortunate there's less cooperation there, but if you can start with, you know, trying to get to the ministers, I'm not sure what you call them here, they're not ministers, they're something else, maybe they're ministers? Directors! Get to the directors and really be able to have them understand how the data can help them make good decisions. That's the biggest step. Once they see that the data can be useful to them, you tend to get a lot more cooperation. So it started with health. All the other ministries came in after the success with the health data. So if you can get the ball rolling, I think it can keep going down the hill. But you're more familiar with the American system than I am, Nathan.
I think one of the things that struck me when I moved up to join them was the close connection that there is between our unit and the ministries. So if we don't have the data to just play with to do whatever we jolly well please. Like Dan said, 60% of our time is spent doing studies for the government to help them understand what's working for them. This isn't one of those studies, this is our own, but so like, for example, and they can be on anything and everything, so I just did one on drivers of hospital costs in Manitoba. Not maternal and child health at all, but and another one on alcohol abuse in Manitoba. So we can be put on any variety of studies to help answer their question. And so they're getting some, it's a reciprocal relationship, right? And it started because of a lot of relationship building from our first director, Dr. Roos, back in the early 90s. And this is the result now, 25 years later, 30 years later.
Yeah, so it'll take you 25 years.
Great, thank you. Any other questions? Okay, let's give the speakers a round of applause.